On this week's 51%, we hear about helping women take the lead.
It's women who are not walking through the doors. It's not the doors that aren't open.
There's hope for reducing child marriages in Africa, and a story about a voodoo queen. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Maybe a reason why all the doors are closed, so you could open one that leads you to the perfect road. Like a lightning bolt, your heart will glow, and when it's time you know, you just gotta ignite the light and let it
We bring you the first installment of a 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom, and as a freelance journalist, she regularly blogs for the Huffington Post. She lives in California's Napa Valley, and this week she interviews Gloria Felt, co-founder and president of Take the Lead, to prepare, develop, inspire, and propel women to take their fair and equal share of leadership positions across all sectors by 2025. Ufberg asks her for the most recent statistics regarding pay parity and corporate boardroom representation.
Well, there's been a little bit of improvement in corporate board representation, but not so much in the pay parity issue. It's been about 20 years that the pay parity, the pay disparity has held pretty firm at somewhere between 77 cents and 78 cents on the dollar. Now, there are variations from location to location, and there are some variations based on entry level to careers versus at the top. We can talk about that momentarily. On the board scene, actually, things have gotten a bit better. In many instances, women are cracking the 20% barrier on boards, but when it comes to the top Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000 boards of directors, women are still at under 20%. I think the latest figures are around 17 to 18%.
Boy, that still seems like we have a long way to go. I know that you've made 2025 your goal for the kind of equity that we're looking for. I'm wondering if you could share what Take the Lead Women is doing to try to remedy the inequity.
Well, first of all, let me just say that Take the Lead's mission is to prepare, develop, inspire, and propel women to take their fair and equal share of leadership positions across all sectors by 2025. That's a big mission because it's about 70 years faster than the current trajectory predicted by the World Economic Forum globally, and it's about 60 years faster than the trajectory we're on in the United States. So we are primarily looking at the United States. And what shocked me to my core was to find out a few years ago upon doing some research for my latest book, No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, that although the doors are open for women and although laws pretty much preclude discrimination, although there are still some issues that need to be dealt with, women were simply not breaking through the 18 to 20% barrier in top leadership positions in any sector. We are 50% of the workforce, but and actually we're about half of the managerial, the lower level supervisory and managerial positions. The higher you go on the pyramid, the smaller number of women you find.
You know, and I find that, you know, when you hear about these statistics, it seems so shocking because of so much of the educational system is, you know, how many women are now really highly educated and highly capable of taking these positions, and certainly have put in the time in, you know, corporate America to, you know, be valued at that top level. I'm just wondering if you have ways that other people can get involved and participate and begin to really be part of this Take the Lead movement.
We encourage everybody to be part of the Take the Lead movement. We see it as being something that everybody can be part of and do something to advance. We have a very comprehensive program, and one of the things that distinguishes us is that our program is comprehensive, whereas most attempts to get more women into leadership roles do one thing. They're either for one profession, or they're about mentoring, or they're about role models, and all of those things are good and valuable and useful, and we think they should happen and they should continue, and we want to support and collaborate with them. But we felt that what we needed to do, somebody needed to do, was to create a really comprehensive program. And then the second thing that we do that is unique is that we focus on what I discovered in my research to be the thing that holds women back more than anything else. And this was the real shocker to me. It was that it's women who are not walking through the doors. It's not the doors that aren't open. So, for example, women are half as likely as men ever to think about running for public office. Women do not negotiate as aggressively as men for their initial compensation. And as a consequence of that, over a lifetime, it costs each of us around an average of $500,000. And if you're a professional woman with a college degree, it may cost you over $1 million in income you do not receive because of not having negotiated that initial compensation as aggressively as your male counterparts.
Does that also include when people do get close to the top that they don't demand or ask for that kind of promotion or position?
It does, exactly right, Sharon. It's women are just simply less likely to raise their hand and say, I'm ready for that job. Women, perhaps rightfully, are more likely to want to know they know what they're doing before they put themselves forward. Whereas they say that if there's a job description and a man sees one or two things he can do, he will apply for it. If a woman sees one or two things she can't do, she'll assume she needs to prepare herself to be able to do those things as well. And one of the things we need to encourage women to do is to take a good look at what your assets are and not be afraid to put yourself forward and you may be honest about, well, you know, these are some areas where I'd want to be sure that I had support to be able to bring myself up to speed, but sure, I can do that job.
I think it's so important, the work that you're doing, Gloria. I am so appreciative that there are women out there like you who are doing things such as your online course where people can apply to this 9 leadership power tools to advance your career. It's so important that people that are listening know that you are not only running this movement but also creating coursework that will help them to have the skill set in order to be able to really feel confident in demanding more and asking more and sharing that with others as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Sharon. And yes, I have developed the online certificate course that I will be teaching. I try to teach it once or twice a year. I plan on teaching it in early 2016. And if people are interested, they can go ahead and go to our website, taketheleadwomen.com, and they can click on the course and they can just say, I'd be interested in you're telling me when it's actually happening, and then we can get in touch with them when we've got the details. So I would encourage people to do that, and I really appreciate your mentioning it because I love teaching this course, and the reason I love it is because it's online, and it's something that even very busy women can do because everything is asynchronous. You can do it at any time, and you can do it from wherever you are. So it's ideal for a woman who's busy, who's got her work, she's got her family, and she just, you know, she can't take time off to go back to school. It is a certificate course, not an academic course, although I do teach an academic version of it as well. But it is a certificate course, so it is something you can add to your resume. And in that course, what I go through is, first of all, we deconstruct the whole issue of power and where women are today and what stands in our way of moving ourselves forward. You know, because we've seen a woman first almost everything, sometimes it's easy, particularly for young women, to think that all the problems have been solved. And then they get into the workplace, and after 5 or 10 years, they begin to see their male colleagues moving faster than they are. Or they're trying to figure out why they're bearing the whole burden of trying to figure out how to do family life and work. And they don't, you know, they just haven't had the skills, which actually are learnable, teachable skills, to know how to deal with all of that. And again, our goal is not to be a huge organization, but to leverage all of the great stuff that exists for women. And also to take that learning that we have and translate it into the 9 specific leadership power tools, because once you know what the problems are, you need to know what the solutions are. So often women are told what the problems are, but then nobody says, here's the solution. In other words, every year on Equal Pay Day, we hear about how the pay gap still exists. Well, okay, so what do we do about it?
That was co-founder and president of Take the Lead, Gloria Felt, speaking with Dr. Sharon Ufberg of 51%'s Force of Nature. You can find Take the Lead online at taketheleadwomen.com and on various social media platforms, including on Twitter at TakeLeadWomen. Child marriage is defined as a union when one or both of the partners are under the age of 18, and more frequently girls are the victims. Rights groups are opposed to child marriage because it robs children of their basic freedoms and deprives them of life-changing opportunities, such as a good education. However, recent research in sub-Saharan Africa shows it is possible to decrease the number of children being forced into wedlock. DW correspondent Ashata Spande brings us more with this report.
Goats, chickens, and books. Believe it or not, but these are some of the simple measures that could prevent child marriages in Africa. The findings of a research conducted in sub-Saharan Africa recently may well be the cure of one of the biggest malaises in African society. But why goats and chickens instead of cash or other financial incentives? Judith Bruce is a policy analyst at the US-based NGO Population Council that carried out the study. She explains it's all about raising the status of women.
Even if other family members have some control of that resource, it does enhance her status. It's a way of giving her a value. Right now, the value of females, particularly young females, is utterly invisible. So even if the goat becomes the household goat, it's still called often by the name of the girl. That's Lila's goat.
Child marriages are rampant in sub-Saharan Africa, where poor parents often marry off their daughters very early for dowry and other financial incentives. The region has the second largest number of child brides in the world after South Asia. 2 out of 5 girls in sub-Saharan Africa are married by the age of 18. The study tested 4 cost-effective strategies to prevent child marriages. They included community conversations, school supplies for girls, and giving families economic incentives to delay marriage. Trials lasting 3 years took place in Tanzania's Tabora region, in Amhara in Ethiopia, and in Cascades in Burkina Faso. The three regions have some of the highest prevalence of child marriages in the continent. Dr. Asha Muhammad is part of United Nations Population Fund's Child Marriage Program in East and Southern Africa.
Child marriage is one of many what we call harmful cultural practices that we are used to, like female genital mutilation. People are used to child marriage from the olden days, and they continue it. Before, it was actually a method of managing girls' sexuality because they were married before they can actually see their breasts or even have a period.
The study showed that in Ethiopia, girls aged between 12 and 14 who had been offered school supplies such as uniforms and books were 94% less likely to be married at the end of a 3-year period than those who had not. Older girls aged between 15 and 17 were half as likely to get married when they were given 2 chickens for every year they remained in education. The offer of 2 goats led to a 2/3 drop in early marriage for the same age group in Tanzania. Judith Bruce again.
The bottom line is that marriage must be understood as deeply tied to local economics, fluctuating with local economics, fluctuating with things like the price of tobacco.
The UN human rights body recognizes child marriage as a violation of human rights. Girls married under the age of 18 are seen to have significantly higher rates of HIV than their unmarried, sexually experienced counterparts. They are more likely to experience forced marital sexual initiation and domestic violence. Dr. Asha Muhammad says child marriage deprives young girls of opportunities which would be of benefit to them in later life.
That's the end of their education. That's the end of their future earning capacities. Then their children are also subjected to a vicious cycle of poverty. And they're more likely to have more children that they cannot afford to take care of than a woman who got married, you know, in her late 20s or late 30s.
The good news is that child marriage is slowly declining. But this decline is uneven and far from comforting. If efforts are not made to accelerate the decline, sub-Saharan Africa will earn the dubious distinction of being the region with the largest number of child brides by 2050.
And that was a report by Deutsche Welle correspondent Ashata Spande. In the mid-1800s, boomtown San Francisco was a city of men, with only about 15% women. Slavery was illegal in the West, but still, white men were the ones cashing out on the boom, mostly. Then there was Mary Ellen Pleasant. She was one of the richest and most powerful people in the state, and she was a black woman. In fact, she was a freedom fighter. They called her the Black City Hall. But today, Pleasant is barely remembered. The story that does get told is a mythologized tale about San Francisco's so-called voodoo queen. Olivia Cueva and Liza Veal bring us the story from KALW's Cross Currents.
The very last stop on a city tour called San Francisco Ghost Hunt brings you to the corner of Octavia and Bush Streets, where Mary Ellen Pleasant's mansion once stood.
Come in close, people, come in close.
Jim Fassbinder guides the tour, and he talks fast. He tells a tale that he admits is not quite fact, not quite fiction. Says Pleasant had power over San Franciscans because she practiced, quote, voodoo. He says that some claim she was responsible for the death of four people, including her longtime business partner. Rumor has it, a servant found Pleasant
pulling apart the bones of his head and picking out bits of his brain.
As the story goes, she's haunted this corner ever since the day she died.
But Mary Ellen Pleasant's real story has been mangled by history. So what really happened?
It still is a mystery. Her life is still a mystery.
Cecile Bibbs has been studying Pleasant for over 20 years.
She wrote a book, produced films, and even wrote and performed a one-woman show all about Mary Ellen Pleasant.
She says part of the reason it's so hard to distinguish fact from fiction is because Pleasant herself never kept her story straight.
It was ingrained from the very beginning that survival meant you don't tell. You just keep secrets.
Bibb says by best accounts, Pleasant was born on a plantation in Georgia. But once she got her freedom as a young girl, she began falsifying her identity. Since slavery was still legal in much of the country, she needed to protect herself from law enforcement.
If they decided she was an escaped slave and she had no freedom papers, they could just arrest her off the streets and back into slavery.
Her skin was fair enough to pass, so when she docked in San Francisco in 1852, she arrived as a white woman.
Pleasant was ambitious. She stepped onto the muddy, smelly Embarcadero wearing a matching black dress and bonnet and immediately saw her business opportunity.
Young men's boarding houses.
Most men, from broke gold miners to rich politicians, lived in these crowded flop houses.
Pleasant decided to build luxurious boarding houses for high society men. Think extravagant balls and elegant banquets.
She had several boarding houses, made other financial investments, and by 1865, she had amassed a $1 million fortune.
She ended up having the most exclusive boarding house in San Francisco.
And that's how she got access to the elite inner circles in the city. Even the governor lived there. He took his oath of office in her boarding house on Washington Street.
She knew how to create loyalty in these men.
A lot of people say, oh, you know, she used blackmail. Well, she did use a kind of blackmail at times, but that wasn't the reason. That wasn't the source of her power. The source of her power was gratitude.
But the whole time she was becoming an influential figure in the city, she was living as a kind of double agent. While most of San Francisco knew her as white, the black community knew that she was black and fighting for abolition.
She was a major link in the Underground Railroad, a funder of slave revolts across the country, and a pillar of the burgeoning black community in the city.
And all that African Americans knew was if they needed something, they would go to her, and somehow she would use her influence and they would get it. And so they called her the Black City Hall.
Pleasant got them housing, jobs, loans. She got legal charges dropped. She made it popular for high society to hire black people. She was determined to make it big and bring her people with her.
Then in 1865, slavery was finally abolished everywhere in the states. So Pleasant decided it was safe to stop passing as a white woman. For the first time, she checked the box marked black on the census. This is Bibbs reading from Pleasant's unpublished memoir.
My cause was the cause of freedom and equality for myself and for my people, and I'd rather be a corpse than a coward.
But there were consequences for fighting white supremacy. In the late 1800s, white San Francisco began to see her not as an insider, but as a villain.
The time when horrible things began to happen for African Americans.
To give some context, the U.S. was struggling to reconstruct itself post-slavery and had fallen into a Great Depression.
You have to look at the times. It was a backlash time.
Newly freed slaves were the ones scapegoated for the downturn. Politicians in favor of civil rights were now being replaced by segregationists.
Mary Ellen Pleasant became a cautionary tale for the country. This is what happens when you let a black woman get too powerful.
Rumors filled the papers.
You can find all kinds of accusations in the press.
That's Lynn Hudson. She also wrote a book about Pleasant. She says the press tried to cut her down to size by giving her the nickname Mammy.
The big, round, smiling black woman with a kerchief on her head, and she's so happy to be a slave. That's the stereotype, right?
Some reporters were mocking Pleasant by portraying her as harmless and subservient. But at the very same time, others would paint her as a powerful witch.
She's a woman with wonderful persuasive powers and a very hypnotic influence over weaker members of her own sex.
This was a time period when reporters played fast and loose with facts, and there were no repercussions. They spread rumors that she was a madam,
that she stole white people's money,
even that she stole babies and sold them on the black market.
She was accused of putting a spell on a senator, sprinkling love potion on his undergarments.
The papers really fixated on Pleasant's voodoo practice.
Because here's the thing, according to Bibbs, she did practice voodoo, or rather voodoon, not the witchy, jinxy, magic stereotype you might be thinking of, but the Haitian religion her mother and grandmother passed down to her.
She was trained as a voodoon priestess, a role which tasked her with protecting and serving her community, the black community of San Francisco.
And the press ran with it. A voodoo queen, the perfect tabloid spectacle.
But Pleasant never cowered from the press or anyone else. She mocked the negative media attention and even played into it, like carrying around a crystal ball as a prop. She wrote in her unpublished memoir,
"Them newspapers, they can say what they want about me. When I'm in a fight, any byplay doesn't faze me."
Eventually, the San Francisco Chronicle, after smearing her for decades, admitted some admiration for her.
In her whole 38 years of residence in California, she has laughed at courts, disobeyed the orders of judges, and has escaped somehow from every tight corner in which she has been placed.
So she carried on, now known as the Voodoo Queen, until the day she died, in 1904, from heart failure.
Her whole life, Mary Ellen Pleasant was fugitive just by virtue of her skin color.
And wicked just by virtue of her gender. But Bibbs won't let that be her legacy.
If you look at Pleasant, you look at a person all alone, brought out of slavery, put into indenture, and how this person rallied every time, you know, came to the top of everything. It's just mind-blowing.
And maybe Pleasant liked the fight. Maybe it's the very thing that spurred her on. Here she is in her own words, read aloud by Bibbs.
"Now, if I'm dead, all right then. But as long as I'm living, I'm going to fight. And I'm going to fight to win. And I don't want to be carried up to victory on flowery beds of ease either. I like to go through bloody scenes."
For Cross Currents, I'm Olivia Cueva.
And I'm Liza Veal.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1369.